Welcome to this Friday edition of The 21st Show. Coming up today, are you ready to go to the movies? Ebert Fest starts in a few weeks. The CEO of Ebert Companies, Chaz Ebert, is my guest. She gives us a preview of what films the festival will feature, but we also talk politics and diversity in Hollywood.
Now, I have to admit, listening to Chris Rock's bit now, as compared to when I first heard it on the day of the Oscars, it kind of stings. It hurts.
And an effort to get rural school girls more excited about math and science via Maker Girls 3D Printing Workshop.
And there's a shape called paraboloid, which is a very odd name. From here, it kind of looks like a triangle, except with a rounded top. Roundish, pointy.
That's all this hour on The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm your host, Nyla Boodoo. Film buffs are already getting excited for the 18th annual Ebert Fest. We're less than a month away from the festival. That'll be April 13th to 17th at the Virginia Theater in Champaign. We know that Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak will open the event, but who else will be there? Well, earlier, I talked with Chaz Ebert, CEO of Ebert Companies, to answer that question and many more.
Great, Nyla. I'm really happy that you invited me to talk about Ebert Fest and everything.
Sure. I feel like I'm looking forward to talking about Ebert Fest. So for the people who are interested in that, stay tuned because we're going to get to that. But I feel like we have to start with the Oscars. And I was looking at your Twitter stream and you tweeted right on to Chris Rock for his introduction and his statements. And I thought we would actually play a little bit of what he said to remind everybody.
It's Hollywood race. You know, you got to go at that the right way. Is it burning cross races? No. Is it fetch me some lemonade racist? No. It's a different type of racist. Now, I remember one night I was at a fundraiser for President Obama. A lot of you were there. And at some point, you get to take a picture with the president, you know? And as they're setting up the picture, you get like a little moment with the president. I'm like, Mr. President, you see all these writers and producers and actors? They don't hire black people. And they're the nicest white people on earth. They're liberals. Cheese. That's right. Is Hollywood racist? You're damn right Hollywood's racist, but it ain't the racist that you've grown accustomed to. Hollywood is sorority racist. It's like, we like you, Rhonda, but you're not a Kappa. That's how Hollywood's, yeah? But things are changing. Things are changing.
So do you think things are changing?
Yes, of course, things are changing. I have to admit, listening to Chris Rock's bit now, as compared to when I first heard it on the day of the Oscars, it kind of stings. It hurts. And he's right. It is not lynching racist or fetch me lemonade or things like that. Things are changing. They're not changing fast enough. And I know what he means about being in that environment with the president where all of the people who are liberals and progressives and, but I bet as he looked around that room that day before they took the picture, these were the writers and the producers and the executives who could greenlight projects. They were probably all white. Other than Chris Rock. So I have to tell you, I'm stunned as I listen to it now because it's really sort of settling in and it has an effect on me that it didn't have when I listened to it the first time. I just sort of laughed because I knew what he meant and I knew he was trying to be funny and factual at the first time, at the same time. But now as I listen into it, ugh.
Because you've also been that person in the room, probably, I imagine. You've also probably been that only person of color in the room with all of these other people for Hollywood. So you say it's not changing fast enough. The one question that I wanted to ask is, as we've had this conversation, I think you have a unique perspective on why you think this is so important. Why is this such an important issue?
The other night I had a dinner for the students that I mentor through the Columbia College Lynx Journalism Program and the Chicago Urban League. And one of the students said, why should we care? It's only an Oscar show, and if you don't want to watch it, don't watch it. And I said, no, it is vitally important because the Oscars are watched by billions of people all over the world. You need to see yourself on that screen. You need to be part of the conversation. Your voice as an African-American filmmaker or film critic or artist should be not only heard, but your face should be seen. You know, there are Latinos who should be seen and heard, Asian Americans, other people of color as well. It matters. Not only will the people around the world decide what they think of you based on our Hollywood export, because movies are a big export from the United States. The culture of the United States is really seen through some people through movies as well as books and everything. But so it matters. We have to show up. You have to show that there are people of color who are doing things that matter as well.
And you mentioned the Lynx program. I know you've been actively involved in a partnership with the Chicago Urban League and Columbia Colleges to have young critics write for RogerEbert.com. How many years have you been doing that?
We did this. This is our third year. The first year, I think we had somewhere between 3 and 5 students. The second year, I'm not. Well, at the dinner the other night, I think there were about 20 people at dinner, and about half of them were students. Others were the people who administer the program. So,
and what do you feel like the students get out of that program?
I can tell you what I hope they get out of the program. I can tell you also, one of the things they said is helps them to focus more on their writing ability. I mean, simple things like grammar and sentence usage, and also the ideas that they're putting forth. Are the ideas well explained? Are they well thought through when they are analyzing a film? I told them one of the really sneaking into the program through the back door of film criticism is one thing. What I really want them to do when I talk about a voice is finding their voice. I want them, their voices, I want them to look critically at everything that happens in their community. Whether they're, it doesn't matter to me whether they become a film critic or not. I want them to be an observer of what happens in their community, in their cities. I want them to be active participants in the process of monies being allocated to their communities, in just things that happen, decisions made about the policemen in the community, things made about education. Starting with film criticism is just one way of saying be a critical observer of everything that goes on around you.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying you're really, it's not just about film criticism, it's about creating better citizens and people being more engaged.
Bingo, yes, absolutely.
And as we talk about that, I mean, I know that one of the things you were inspired to do, as we're talking about citizenship, is you were inspired at this year's TED conference to create a call for action, not for citizens, but for people running for national office. And you're calling it hashtag 30%. What's that about?
Hashtag 30% is something I thought of about 2 years ago, but I didn't really discuss it with anyone because I thought it sounded so idealistic that no one would ever take it seriously. And the more I thought about it, a lot of ideas, a lot of good ideas, a lot of good changes that are made started with things that people thought were too idealistic. You know, maybe even something like Obamacare, health care for people in the country. But hashtag 30%, I think I said, wouldn't it be great if we could change our laws to allow politicians to use 30% of the monies that they get in a campaign fund to solve a real world problem? For instance, I saw that somewhere that one aspect of the Flint water lead poisoning problem could be resolved with $56 million. Hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent on our presidential campaign. What if each of the national politicians, whether Republican or Democrat, put 30% of their money in an aggregated fund, and maybe people vote on the issues, maybe people on social media define some of the issues. Maybe resolving the Flint water problem is one of them. But maybe the funds are used, and then the politicians can say, this is the list of problems. This is the one I want to resolve with my 30%. Or maybe they let their constituents vote on it. And then at the end of the presidential campaign or a senatorial campaign, people can vote on a candidate based on their deeds as well as their words. I'm so sick of the obscene amount of monies being spent on political campaigns that are used only to savagely attack their opponents. It doesn't make any sense. And so that's my soapbox, the hashtag 30%.
Chaz, do you think that would change the tone of this current campaign nationally and as we're seeing locally and here in Illinois?
It absolutely would change the tone of the campaign. Did you notice, for instance, I'm just going to use one example. Donald Trump, he said, instead of going to the debate, I'm going to have a gathering for vets and I'm going to raise money. I don't know what happened, if he really raised money or what happened, but he said that he was going to raise whatever, let's say $6 million for vets. When he came back, when he talked about that, and he talked about the vets, and he talked about doing something for them, that's almost the only time in this whole presidential campaign that I saw him being civil, engaged, more focused on a problem and on people that he cared about, and not just attacking the other people. I think if they're talking about some real-world problem that they're solving, you can't help but change the tone of the campaign.
We're talking culture and politics with Chaz Ebert. She's the publisher of Ebert Digital. She's president of Ebert Productions. And, you know, Chaz, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking so much about how you've often said that Roger, your late husband Roger, said that movies are an empathy machine, and so much about cultivating these notions that you're talking about, primarily empathy. And I mean, we were discussing that with students, the high school students, and I wonder, is that also part of the new Ebert Center? I know last year you announced the creation of that. Is that the goal of that, doing this work at the collegiate level here in Champaign-Urbana?
Yes, that's one of the goals. The Ebert Center will be a place, and just to clarify, it's not a center yet until we raised $5 million.
How's that going?
I think we're about halfway to our goal, so it's going well, but it could be going better. One of the things that we would like to do is encourage emerging artists and filmmakers and even technologists to tell stories that matter, to tell stories that have a social impact. Now, all of the stories they tell don't have to have a social impact because people love all kinds of stories. Science fiction and comedies, even within those different genres, I think there is room to consider principles like empathy or kindness or compassion in your art. Sometimes you can consider it in a way that shows the opposite of that. You know, that's another one of my soapboxes. I do think that there's not enough empathy. I do think that if we take the time to put ourselves in the skin or shoes of another person, a person of another race or age or a socioeconomic circumstance, we would be able to understand each other more. I think that we would have more compassion for each other. And I can't emphasize that enough. You know, you're just talking to me at a time when I am so disgusted by what's going on in this presidential campaign. It really almost brings me to tears. I look at what are the young people learning from this? What are they learning? The other night at dinner, when I was talking to those high school students, my heart was soaring because they were talking about things, about caring for each other. They were saying that when they were watching the movies and they were writing about them, it also made them think a little differently about other people, or it made them want to at least inquire about what someone else is going through. That's empathy.
This might be a simplistic question, but I wonder if you do truly believe that art and that film and that people being able to step into other shoes, whether that's gender or, as you've said, you know, whether that's race or gender or religion or socioeconomic background, do you think it's as simple as that? Like, that solves everything we've been talking about diversity in Hollywood, if people are seeing other people and experiencing other people, do you really think that's what can help change the tone and change sort of the culture of what we're seeing right now?
I do think it can help. I don't think there's one thing that's a panacea. I'm not that naive. I do know there are studies that neuroscientists conduct. When you see a movie that has, let's say, a lot of, I'm just using the word, car chases and explosions and people killing each other and being mean, when you leave the theater, you experience more road rage on your way home. You are likely to drive faster, listen to louder music, talk louder, be more aggressive in those, you know, just those moments afterwards. And when you see a movie where you see people being kind to each other, doing good things, and it leaves you going out being more thoughtful, you know, give the next person a break. There are just all these studies about how things are affected. It doesn't mean that it's a direct one-to-one cause, but it certainly can help.
Coming up, I continue my conversation with Chaz Ebert with an eye towards what you can expect at next month's Ebert Fest. We just tweeted out a link, by the way, to Chaz Ebert's 30% idea. If you follow 21st Show on Twitter, you can find out more. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking movies.
It began with a sound that no one was ever supposed to hear.
He's one of us all.
Yes, he says he pulled the girl out of the car.
I would like you to forget about her.
Yeah, that's what I heard just before the tire blew out.
I'm here to take you away.
There's nowhere else to go. This is your home now.
You just heard Anton Karas' theme from the 1949 classic The Third Man, one of Roger Ebert's top 10 all-time great films. We're going to have more on that in a minute. Part of the original trailer for the 1981 Brian De Palma thriller Blowout, including a line dialogue from Nancy Allen, who will be a guest at Ebert Fest in a few weeks, and a clip from Guillermo del Toro's 2015 gothic romance Crimson Peak, the opening night film for the 18th annual Ebert Fest. Thanks to Jeff Bossert for producing that for us. It's all because of a conversation we're having with Chaz Ebert, CEO of Ebert Companies. When I spoke with her, I also asked Chaz who else we could expect.
First of all, I'm thrilled that Guillermo del Toro is opening the festival because he was one of Roger's favorite filmmakers. And Roger at one point said that we should have something honoring the current Mexican filmmakers. Which brings me to another point. I'm digressing because when we talked about the hashtag Oscars So White mm-hmm. campaign, mm-hmm. people forget that Alejandro Iñárritu is Mexican. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about diversity, and a Mexican director won the Oscars 2 years in a row.
2 years in a row, right.
I think that's pretty awesome. But
there was also that first Oscar for Chile that also happened this year as well. So that's a good,
yes.
It's an important point to make.
Yes. And I don't want people to overlook that. But Guillermo del Toro did Pan's Labyrinth, which was, you know, universally praised. And I'm looking forward to his Crimson Peak. He is also not only a good storyteller, He engages his audiences. That's one of the reasons I wanted him at Ebertfest. He's a very sort of a gracious host, a gracious guest to have. He carries around little notebooks and he sketches all of these things all the time. And the audiences just like him a lot. So I'm glad he's coming to Ebertfest. Roger would have been very happy to have him
a
guest.
Right.
We are also having the Michael Polish, who did a film, North Fork, and he also did a film, Twin Falls, Idaho, that I hope to have at Ebertfest one day. These are films that I think Roger gave 4 stars to both of them. I knew North Fork, Roger just loved. He said that it was like watching a myth or a fairy tale unfold, and I'm glad that Michael Polish will be there, and he will be bringing his wife, Kate Bosworth. So
those are a couple other ones.
Yes, we have, somebody I'm really, really happy to have, Renee Baker and the Chicago Modern Orchestra Project. This is like a 13-piece orchestra that we're trying to fit down into our Ebertfest pit at the Virginia Theater, and I think normally...
Wow. Are they going to... So they're going to be playing?
Yes, the whole 13-piece orchestra. And I think the biggest orchestra we've had down there was like maybe 10 pieces.
That's what I was thinking. Okay, well, that'll be interesting to see that one.
Yes, yes. And the thing that Renee Baker is bringing is Body and Soul, which was one of the first Paul Robeson roles, and he plays both the villain and the preacher. So... this is a silent movie, and the orchestra plays along with it.
And so that and film is Body and Soul.
Yes, Body and Soul.
And the orchestra will be playing that. Wow, okay.
Yes. Now, I'm really looking forward to having Radical Grace. That's a movie about the nuns who had a falling out with the Vatican because they wanted to continue to stay in the communities and work on sort of social justice issues and feeding the poor and clothing them, rather than just telling women, you know, not to use birth control or whatever. They wanted to continue to do things. And so they had the nuns on the bus, if you remember that time.
Yes,
I do. They went all over America. Mm-hmm. So I've met some of these nuns.
Yeah.
I am so thrilled that they're coming to Ebertfest.
So the nuns are coming.
Yeah. You know, one of the sisters died since the film was made. So we're trying to... We're trying to determine which one is coming. But in addition to the filmmakers, Rebecca Parrish and, Nicole Bernard Reese, we are having one of the sisters, maybe Sister Simone.
Wow. Okay, that would be that's something to look forward to. Now, I know one of the Third Man is one of the films that you all.
Yes.
And I know that was one of Roger's top 10 films ever. I wonder if I could ask how Roger, how he helped you appreciate this.
Appreciate
the
what
film? I don't know what the film. Yes.
Well, one of the reasons that Roger and I got along so well is because I always appreciated films. I even when we met, I always liked a variety of films, foreign films, independent films, and A Third Man was a favorite of mine.
Oh, was
well
of yours
I
too?
Met
oh,
Roger.
Okay. So it was the mutual favorite that you had. Okay,
yes,
great.
It
oh,
was.
That's good.
But it is in his top 10 list. And in fact, I'm glad you asked about Roger, because one of the things that I'm doing this year is bringing a few older films, not only The Third Man, but Blowout. And we're having Nancy Allen from Blowout. And these are films that not only do we, were they given good reviews by Roger, we have clips of Roger reviewing some of them that will also be shown at Ebertfest. So,
go ahead.
And Casey Lemons, who did Eve's Bayou, will be with us. Eve's Bayou was one of Roger's, he loved that film so much. He'd be so happy that we're having it at Ebertfest.
Oh, that sounds great. Any other ones you want to fill us in on?
Let me see. Oh, we're having Force of Destiny and Paul Cox, the Australian director who's coming in, who's been at Ebertfest several times before with his film about Vincent van Gogh and some other films. He's coming. And the reason I sound like that, I'm so happy because, you know, he had a liver transplant.
Oh, my.
And he had been sick, and he was supposed to come 1 year, and he couldn't make it. But he's going to travel slowly, probably not take a nonstop flight to get here so he can rest a bit. But he's determined to make it to Ebertfest, and so we're looking forward to welcoming Paul Cox back to Ebertfest with his film, Force of Destiny.
Chaz, as you say this, and as you mentioned a couple of the older films that you're bringing back, this is the fourth festival that's been programmed without Roger. And is that how you've tried to kind of keep his influence on the festival, by bringing in some of the ones that he maybe always wanted to include?
Yes, that's one of the ways that we're doing it. And I also like using films where we have either a clip of Roger or his review of some of the films. That's to keep him involved in the festival. Right from the beginning, though, Roger and I and Nate Cohen sort of decided on the films together for the whole 18 years. This will be our 18th year. So there are some years where I can go back through the years and tell you which films were my picks. But Roger had the last word, of course, on what the whole slate of movies would be. He was the film critic, the Pulitzer Prize-winning film critic, as he would remind me.
It wouldn't let you forget that.
Yes. So, of course, he had the last word on the films. But I always helped program the festival from the very beginning.
And now do you feel like do you still have those notes of his input, or how do you, you're the final word now?
Well, Nate Cohen and I have been programming the festival together since Roger passed away. But both Nate and I, when Roger and I used to drive home from the festival, if he was driving, I would be writing in a book. We did a postmortem. What worked, what didn't work, which movies would we like to see in years? So I have little notebooks that I used to take on our drives home and to write down list of movies. So I have notebooks from every year that we drove home with movies that we wanted to see. So we could still program the festival for years to come with some of his suggestions. Nate also discussed movies with Roger, and he also has a list of films that Roger would want to see. But in addition to that, even from the beginning, we would also go out to festivals and, especially in more in recent years, seek out films that we think our audience would want to see, whether they were older films or newer films. So
that said, what are you most looking forward to seeing in the film festival this year when you're here in Champaign?
Oh, my God.
Is it fair for me to ask you, is there one?
No.
You're because not allowed to say which is your favorite.
No. I'm allowed to say that, but because I'm choosing them, I want to see all of them. I am so excited to see these films again, because it's not just the film, it's the whole experience. I hope people realize how fortunate they are to see films on that huge screen at the Virginia Theater. You don't see screens like that almost anywhere these days. We have the capability to show 70 millimeter, black and white. We have, there's another, I can't remember the name of it, but our projectionist, James Bond, is one of the best. He, and that's his name, James Bond.
Of course, James Bond at the Virginia Theater.
All around the world to set up their screening rooms and to project films for them. So and that Ebertfest audience, I love them. Most of them have been coming either from the beginning or, you know, for many years, and it's like a family there. So to see it communally, no one pulls out a smartphone to look at during the movies. No one talks during the movies. It's such a civil and civilized environment to watch movies in. So, you know, really, you should come to Ebertfest. I guarantee you a good time.
If you, for someone who maybe is listening to this, who's never gone to Ebertfest or maybe thinks, oh, these films might be intimidating or this isn't my kind of movie experience, what would you say to encourage them to come?
I would say you owe it to yourself to experience cinema in its high, in its most enjoyable state. That is, on a big screen with avid moviegoers, great sound, and the guests who talk about the films afterwards, the filmmakers who come, and also our panelists of film critics and others who help do the Q&A, it enriches filmmaking in a way that you can't get looking at a film on your smartphone or even going to a movie theater. I love movie theaters, but this is just value-added things that you get at the Ebertfest experience.
Are there any other films that you're excited about for the festival we haven't talked about yet?
Yes, one of the films that we decided to show this year, because it's an election year, is Being There. Now, I probably shouldn't mention it because we don't have our confirmation yet, but I hope Shirley MacLaine hears this and that she is coming to our festival because she's been invited. And Being There, if you remember, is Chauncey Gardner, and who people think is a presidential candidate because of things he says, and they don't realize that he really doesn't understand what he's saying. He's really, when he talks about working in his garden, he means literally working in a garden. It wasn't a metaphor. So
okay. So the Ebertfest will be April 13th to 17th at the Virginia Theater. That's the 2016 Ebertfest. Chaz Ebert, thanks for taking the time for this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Chaz Ebert, CEO of Ebert Company. It's lots to look forward to at Ebertfest coming up next month. And you can learn more about how Ebertfest got started and preview this year's festival in a new TV documentary. It's called Ebertfest 2016, Center of the Universe, that will air on many PBS stations starting next month. So check with your local station for airtimes on that. I wanted to take a listen right now to The Third Man. As you heard Chaz say, some of her and Roger's favorite films that will be part of this year's festival. Here's a little bit of that music. Music from The Third Man, one of Chaz and Roger Ebert's favorite films, part of this year's Ebertfest. Coming up, getting girls in Illinois interested in science, one 3D printer at a time. We live tweet during our show. You can send questions and comments to our handle, at 21st Show, or you can find us on Facebook, search The 21st Show. Stay with us. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and this is The 21st. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Men continue to outnumber women in many fields of science and engineering. One Illinois program, Maker Girl, is trying to narrow that gap, especially in rural areas. That's where they want to give girls hands-on experience with 3D printing. In a few minutes, we'll be speaking with one of the creators of that program. But first, our producer, Christine Herman, went to a Maker Girl workshop to see what it's all about.
Disney tunes are playing in the background when I walk into the 3D printing lab in the business instructional facility.
That is so awesome. I love that.
Six girls who had signed up for the space theme session are seated at computers along the periphery of the room. In the middle are 12 3D printers, cube-shaped devices not much bigger than a toaster oven, which would be used later in the evening to print out the designs the girls are working on.
My name is Caitlin Deegan, and I'm a sophomore in materials science and engineering.
She's leading today's workshop.
This is Print Your Way to Space. So today we're going to be printing things that have to do with space. So they could come up with anything, like they could print an alien if they want to, a spaceship, like anything, a planet.
I'm going to design Mars, which is just going to be a sphere with kind of a ridge, because there's this valley. I think it starts with an M. I don't really remember, but...
That's 8-year-old Nora. She's pretty into this project. She likes to sit in front of the computer with her legs scrunched up on the chair and her arms wrapped around her knees.
Well, you basically use that design maker thing. I suppose if this is going to be for the radio, people won't see it, but it's like a grid where you can put 3D shapes on it. It's called Tinkercad, and the grid is blue, and the different shapes are different colors. And there's a shape called paraboloid, which is a very odd name. From here, it kind of looks like a triangle, except with a rounded top. Roundish, pointy.
She doesn't end up using that roundish, pointy shape in her design, but she chose a couple of other shapes to make Mars.
I have just a sphere with a cylinder hole on its side. I might do maybe something on the top and bottom to be like the poles, because it's like a little bump or something. If I can find out how to do that.
One of the volunteers helps Nora get the poles in place. Then they transfer the file to an SD card and bring it over to a 3D printer.
There we go. Let me make sure it's actually functioning. I don't know what we'll do if it's not, honestly. Oh, yep, it's working.
The printer takes a minute to warm up.
It's going to take quite a while. Why is the time left increasing? It's saying, like, time left 1 hour. That's kind of crazy.
It didn't take an hour to print, maybe like 10 minutes. But when you're 8, that can feel like forever.
But the fact that it takes forever probably implies that it's a really good project, so...
Nora stares through the clear front window of the 3D printer as she watches her design print out layer by layer.
It's done half of the circle so far. It's tiny, but the whole thing had to be tiny, so...
Nora's design is finally complete. It's about the size of a small keychain.
Smells not very good, actually. But it's heated up plastic, so... Eh. I don't think that heated up plastic really does ever smell very good.
I ask Nora what she plans on doing with it.
Maybe, like, show it to friends, like... Here's this model of Mars that I 3D printed. By the way, 3D printing is really cool, or something.
The point of Maker Girls is to show girls how science is cool and can be used to help people. Maybe then they'll grow up and want to be a scientist or an engineer or...
So tell her about what you want to be when you grow up.
That's kind of personal.
So. But Nora tells me she does like science and library. As for what Nora wants to be when she grows up, she never did tell me, so we'll just have to wait and see. For the 21st, I'm Christine Herman.
And Maker Girl co-founder Julia Harriet joins us now in studio. She's a master's student at the University of Illinois. On the line with us from Macomb is Western Illinois University Assistant Professor Abba Singh. She's a science education researcher. Julia, Professor Singh, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Julia, let's start with you. We just heard the story of Nora, one of your Maker Girl participants. Is she the type of girl you're trying to reach?
Yeah, exactly. We love having girls like Nora, as you heard through the before piece. She loved Maker Girl. She really understood what we were doing and really took advantage of the opportunity to kind of create something that she wanted in the world.
Professor Singh, when you hear the story of Nora, she's 8. As a researcher, I wonder, what does it make you think about Nora's exposure to science as an 8-year-old girl?
I definitely think that she can have much more exposure to science also. It's a good thing that she has this exposure, but like her, there can be many, many more students, I think, who can benefit from these kind of exposures just because of how the labor market is. We have to look ahead in the future for girls and for children like Nora who would benefit greatly, yeah.
Is there specific research, Professor Singh, yet on girls and the difference early exposure to science can make for them?
Generally, there is very little research, but usually what is mentioned regarding the evidence and research that's out there is for generally elementary students. There isn't much information provided to them. There isn't much science, at least in the Western Illinois area here. Science isn't provided to them early on, so that their curiosity and their interest, if it has been at such at the earlier age, hasn't been developed. And so we are left with them not at all interested in science by the time they reach middle and high school.
Yeah, because by then, if they haven't been exposed by middle and high school, do you think it's too late?
It is very late, I think so. Because science becomes very challenging, and it becomes more difficult to do science if you don't know the real basics of science early on.
Julia, I wonder what your exposure was to science when you were a much younger woman, and if that kind of was what was behind you starting Maker Girl.
Yeah, I think it definitely was. When I was young, I had two older brothers, so we played with rockets. We played with a lot of Legos. We hatched chicks when we were little. So we had a lot of STEM activities when we were young.
And you think that led to you now doing a Master's of Accountancy in Science at University of Illinois?
Yes, I think it definitely did. It definitely piqued my interest, and especially after starting Maker Girl, I wish I had loved science even more and had more programs like Maker Girl to really show me that I could do really cool things.
I want to talk a little bit more about Maker Girl, Julia, because we heard about the Print Your Way to Space workshop. What other Yes. workshop themes do you offer?
Yeah, so we offer a wide range. So we do culinary creation. So we talk about 3D printing and how it affects the culinary industry. So currently they have a 3D printer that prints chocolate, which is pretty cool. We have a passion for fashion. So a company called Bobble Bar actually creates iterations of their jewelry pieces in 3D prints before they produce them. So it cuts down on costs for them.
And right now I know Maker Girl is in three locations for you all, in Champaign, Chicago, and Southern Illinois. But you're raising money through a Kickstarter campaign for a road trip. What's that about?
Yeah, exactly. So as the professor was speaking to, there's not a lot of resources for girls, especially in rural areas. So we're launching Maker Girl Goes Mobile, and we're going to reach rural areas with this 3D printing mobile truck. So we're going to go all across the country and teach about 1,500 attendees how to 3D print.
And how do you think 3D printing, why do you think that's such an important part of the process? Is it because it gives them something tangible?
Yeah, exactly. So kind of why we started with 3D printing is because we have this amazing 3D printing lab. It was one of the first 3D printing labs in a business school. So, and along with what you just said, yes, there is something tangible that the girls get to actually take home. And for girls, that's really meaningful, and they can show their friends, like Nora said in the video before.
And you actually brought a couple things along with us. Unfortunately, not Nora's Mars, because I imagine she took that home with her.
She did.
But is that a chess piece, that gray thing that you have there?
So this is also a piece from the Print Your Way to Space, and a young girl printed Earth. She wrote Earth
that's
on
Earth.
The side.
Okay.
Yes. And then she made a little body, so it kind of mimics her with different shapes.
And Julia, we heard Nora talking about shapes and other spatial. What kind of skills are they learning? Spatial skills, sort of planning? What kind of things go into creating these objects?
Sure. So they're using a CAD software. So they're learning how to CAD, which is awesome. And they're also drawing shapes and then kind of changing them in order to create what they want. So they don't just necessarily have a house that they can just put on the CAD software and print. So they actually have to get the square and then the triangle and put all the different pieces together in order to create the shape that they want.
And then do they also have to, I imagine, kind of figure out if that's a workable design? Does the software say, this won't work if they're trying to do something a certain way?
Yeah, exactly. So you can't just print in midair, which is a problem that we sometimes have and that we try to teach girls, and that the girls actually need to learn in real life, and that's actually that they need to implement in science.
And for Maker Girl, what ages are you specifically targeting?
We have girls ages 7 to 10.
Okay. Yeah. Professor Singh, as we're hearing about Maker Girl, in particular the skills that these very young women are learning, earlier you mentioned that there's not much exposure. Are there specific regulations for Illinois education about how much elementary school children, how much science they need to be exposed to?
There is no requirement. It really is dependent on the school administrators, the school principal, and also very, very much dependent on the school teacher. And especially the classroom teacher. If the classroom teacher is confident in science, they'll bring in the science element to a huge degree. And if there is a little hiccups regarding how much they know about science, then there won't be any science in the classroom. So it's really dependent on individuals who are actually running the program.
And to your knowledge, is there data on how much science is offered at the elementary level throughout the state of Illinois?
Data as such isn't available, but from the National Assessment of Educational Progress from 2011, information is available for each state regarding how much our students are actually performing in as far as science goes. And there are only 34% based on the NAEP 2011 data, which is the most current available as of now. 66% of students in grade 4 are not performing at an average level for science.
So you're saying two-thirds of fourth graders in Illinois are below standards of what we would want them to be in terms of science knowledge and education.
Absolutely.
Wow. And how much of this do you think is because of an emphasis on Common Core standards? I know that's a whole other conversation, but I was just curious about what your thoughts were on that as a science researcher.
Yeah. I can identify three main factors. And again, this is from research that's out there, and it's from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, as well as the NAEP. There are three main reasons that are, I think, underlying, and this is something that I definitely agree with, that the curriculum and instruction for science is absent. And there may be brief themes that actually are taught at that, from kindergarten to maybe fourth grade, and dependent on the level that the teacher is comfortable with. So there may not be any curriculum existing for science, and the National Science Education Standards, which are the current ones, the Next Generation Science Standards, are not mandatory for everybody to follow. So obviously the teachers don't follow them. So curriculum and instructions are absent. Then the educator development, as far as the pre-service teacher, and then professional development for them. And of course, the standards that they address. Common Core, yes, is for only math and literacy, and science is absent from the Common Core, and therefore the Next Generation Science Standards were instated.
So, Professor Singh, it sounds like you're saying curriculum and then also educational standards,
education for educator development, and then standards are sort of the three things that need to be developed.
We just have about a minute left, so I wanted to ask both of you, when you talk with Professor Singh, particularly teachers, Julia, when you speak with parents, what do you tell them about how to get girls more interested in science like this? Julia?
Sure. So we definitely want these girls to be active in all different types of STEM, not just Maker Girl. So we also provide them with a bunch of resources and a newsletter that goes out monthly so that they continue STEM education at home or in different programs.
We'll have all the links about Maker Girl up on our website at 21st Show. And if you follow us on Twitter, we'll put that information out as well. Professor Singh, thanks so much for joining us as well. I wonder if you just have, just really briefly, is there one or two words of advice you could offer for parents?
Yeah, the big advice that I can offer to anyone is, I'll say what my parents used to say to me, that you educate a man, you educate a man. But when you educate a woman, you educate a whole village. so if you put in a lot of the influx and the potential into a girl, I think it goes way beyond.
Thank you. Thanks for that. I appreciate that. It's Professor Abba Singh, who teaches curriculum and instruction at Western Illinois University. Thanks also to Julia Harriad, a co-founder of Maker Girl and a graduate student here at the University of Illinois. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the 21st today. On Monday, we'll be talking about President Obama's historic trip to Cuba and what that means for Illinois businesses, especially our corn and soy farmers. The 21st is produced by Amanda Cunningport and Christine Herman. Jay Croft is our technical director. He gets help from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. And a special shout out today to the band Public Access for some of the music you've heard this week on the show. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is the 21st.